Thank you, Ruth. Hi, everybody. Well, I bring greetings to you from your General Service Office in New York, and from Bill W., and from the Grapevine. My name is Paula Carpenter, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so happy to see so many women here, because I can recall the horrible feeling of the stigma and the belief when I went to my first couple of meetings that I was the only woman alcoholic. Of course, you can see my self-concern there, and that the women around me were all spouses of. They couldn't possibly be alcoholics. Another reason I am delighted to be here and to find it such a joy, I've only been here 24 hours and I feel as if I really belonged, as if I have been here for a long, long time, which is a wonderful feeling, and I know many of you also feel that. But it is a marvelous feeling to be able to stand here and to talk with you, because a little over 14 years ago, I discovered that I could not communicate with anyone, that I never had communicated with anyone, not myself, nor my God, nor anyone, until I came to AA. And for the first time, communicated with another human being. I can't recall just when I took my first drink, and I don't think it's very important. I came from a family, a loving family, a permissive family, one in which there was a good deal of drinking. Of the children, I was the only one who became an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic, and I can say this because I know full well, or how could I identify so completely with him? Because I can identify now with all men as well as women. We may not have the same background, the same situations, but within each of us, we have the same inner story and problem. Just as I had certainly had an entirely different background from Fred last night. And yet, during that whole talk, wonderful talk of his, I could identify completely with everything he said. I drank in my 20s, in my early 20s, regularly. I often think that whereas they say the alcoholic is the last person to know, in hindsight, I am quite certain that I was the first person to know. Because why else would I have hidden alcohol as I did? Why else would I have sneaked it? I wouldn't face it, but it was certainly in my subconscious. But the most horrible thought to me was the stigma of being an intoxicated woman, because I didn't use the word alcoholic. How horrible for one's husband, who likes to and wants to look up to the woman that he married, who wants to respect her, and instead he comes home night after night to find her incoherent and flat, dirty, and inarticulate. This is rough on a man, and I think it's a little tougher on a woman, because being a woman, we know that we are, in a sense, supposed to lead the way. But as I say, in my 20s when I drank, I know now that I was an alcoholic, perhaps from my first drink, because I never drank as much as I wanted to. Of course, I ended drinking far more than I wanted to. But I didn't have to. It had not progressed enough. I started in the 20s a long period of what I call controlled drinking, which lasted until I came into AA some 20 years later. Because this was easy in the 20s. I could stop. I was younger. It had not built up. But I do know that by the time I was 30, surely I was a full-blown alcoholic. Now, I had a happy life. I loved my husband, or so I thought. I loved my life. I had, at this time, a bookshop which was right across from Grand Central Station in New York City. And I loved books. I had been writing reviews for the Times and various publications, and it was the sort of life I liked, one that I should not think would cause anybody through unhappiness or misery to turn to alcohol. But nevertheless, my drinking was stepping up. When my husband began to notice this, I did everything in my power to assure him that I was a little mental. Anything to me was better than to say I had too much to drink. And I think he believed me. He said that he had noticed tensions. But gradually, I found that I couldn't always guarantee my behavior. One day, I had gone into my place of business. I had been out for about 2 days. And my husband had come in and was working to keep our investment alive. I told him I was fine, and he went out to have a bite to eat. And I had a lot of miniatures with me. And, of course, I drank them. And I passed out in a public place of business. And when I came to, the manager of this huge building in New York, one of the largest, was standing outside the door, had locked it, and our next door neighbor came in and took me into her shop. This, of course, was very bitter medicine for me to swallow, because I was a very arrogant person. I had tremendous pride, and I had a fear of the stigma of alcoholism, of being a drunken woman, and yet that was what I was. Gradually, over a period of time, this built up to the point when there were 3 days and at the end 3 weeks which I could not get out of bed. In the morning, there were amusing incidents in this. I can't recall them, and perhaps it's just as well. My husband worked very hard to help me, and each time that I had been on a binge, he really 12-stepped me. He of course tried to taper me off, and you know what happens when you taper off. There's no such thing. You taper on, and that is what happened. But each time he believed, as I did, that it would be the last time. Believe me, he didn't stay with me to the bitter end because he found me so fascinating. It was because he had infinite patience and faith, something that I have never had. I remember that summer of 1955, a time in which I was desperately struggling with control. And I say now that I hope, God forbid, that if I should ever take another drink, or take that first drink, that I would drink the bottle down and drink myself into bed immediately. Because the pain of controlled drinking, if any of you have been through, you know what it is. To try and pretend that you are sober when you are drunk. To go out on a weekend and everybody gets up to play tennis and go swimming and you're dying and you wonder how you can find the host liquor to have some liquor. You can't move. You'll join them later. All the things that mean anything in life to me. That was cheating, stealing, lying. It's so wonderful not to ever have to lie again, not to ever have to steal again, not to ever have to cheat again. So during that summer, and it was a 3-month summer, I was neither drunk nor sober. Liquor didn't help me anymore. I was compelled to drink it. And I felt that I had no willpower at all. I had heard this said, that I was weak, that I had no willpower. Well, I don't know. I know that I've still since understood that we have plenty of willpower. The will is the faculty which initiates choice and desire. And the power is that which brings it into realization. So I can only say that I willed with all my heart to get a drink and I used every bit of power to get it. Until I wanted to change. Until I wanted to change. Finally, at the end of August, or in the middle of August in 1955, I had been in bed for close to 3 weeks. I had eaten nothing. Each day I would get up and I would pray that my husband would stay and keep me from drinking, that he would find my liquor, or I would pray the next minute that he would leave immediately so that I could call and order liquor. The moment that the liquor arrived, I could put it on the table. I didn't have to open it. It was my security. I could do the surface. I could make the beds. I could brush my hair. And then I would take the drink. And that would enable me to call up the next liquor store and tell them that the check would be under the door until I had my security and supply in. One thing I never did, I never left any for the next morning, because that is about the only faith I had. I always believed that it would be different the next day. But a day came when I sat on the side of the bed. Nothing was different. Nothing was better. Nothing was worse. And I said, don't think now, as if I ever had been thinking. Tomorrow will be different. And suddenly, I knew that tomorrow wouldn't be different. It wouldn't be better. It might be worse. But it wouldn't be different. I dressed. I walked over. I was within walking distance of our place of business. And I went up to my husband. Meantime, I had, 2 years before this, begun seeking. I had gone to doctors. I had lied to doctors. They had agreed with me. Until finally I had gone to one who was an expert in the field of alcoholism. And he had put me in the hospital twice, but not for alcoholism. It was alcoholism. I had tried to call him this day, and he was out of town. The doctors in New York all meet, I think, on the 31st of July and leave en masse until after Labor Day. There is no such thing as a doctor. I went over to my husband's office, and I said to him, "I can't stop drinking. I need help." Never had I said this before. And so at this point I say that never underestimate the wonderful help that can be given by a non-alcoholic, especially if they care. My husband turned to me and he said, "Paula, go home. I will bring you help." And I had to go home. And I had to continue drinking. And I looked at it, and I hated it, but I had to drink. And at 6 o'clock, he brought a doctor who had to climb 3 flights of stairs. The doctor looked at me, and he said, "You are very sick. Will you let me call Intergroup?" Well, I didn't know what he was talking about. But the idea that anybody would ask me or my advice on anything, I just said yes. He did. There was a bed at Knickerbocker Hospital. I was in it at 8 o'clock that night. And I can recall when I stood outside, he had given me injections, and he said, "Now be cautious walking down the stairs." As I say, I was neither drunk nor sober. I was a zombie. But I stood there, and the fear came into my whole being. Now, I'm going into this hospital of AAs. It was a floor. It was not an AA hospital, but that is the way I thought of it. And I was leaving behind the bottles, under the mattress, in my husband's closet, which was a clever move, I thought, and in the hamper. And I had a terrible moment of fear. But you know, it's a strange thing. From that moment until this moment that I'm standing here, I have never really been compelled or desired a drink of alcohol in any form. This is not to my credit that I did not have any slips. It isn't. I had plenty before. But at Knickerbocker Hospital, like Fred last night when his sister helped him, I was able to eat. I hadn't eaten in 3 weeks. I ate and I couldn't believe it. And the next morning, I wondered whether it would still continue. And it did. I ate. I was unable to communicate, to talk to anybody. They had the big book there. I couldn't look at it. I was there for 5 days. I was very sick, physically. I didn't sleep, and they told me that nobody had ever died for lack of sleep. And at the end of 5 days, and of course they treated me there like a sick alcoholic, a sick woman. When I had been in the hospitals, 2 hospitals, before in New York, I had reached the point, and that was over 14, well, that was about 15 years ago, in which I would not ring for a drink of water because the nurse had come in at one point and said, "We are busy here. There are sick people in this hospital." Well, the last time that I was in the hospital, the second time, I got up before the change of shift at 6 o'clock in the morning, dressed, and got out. It was too cruel. Things are changing so beautifully now. It is heartwarming. But it still is a long, long road. Because going over, as far as stigma goes, going over to Bill's dinner in a cab 2 weeks ago, we were caught in traffic. The driver turned to me and he said, "I'm sorry, lady, that we have to wait like this, but that is busy. Sorry, I can't offer you a cocktail. And I started to laugh. And I said, well, I don't think that would be very seemly. I said, I am going to the 35th anniversary dinner of the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he looked at me and he said, and you look like such a nice lady. So there you are. Well, then I started to go around to groups in AA after I came out of Knickerbocker Hospital. And I came home and I told my husband, I said, you know, they tell me that this is an illness. And he said, but of course. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, I knew that you were ill. I knew it. I don't know whether it was a disease, but I knew that you were ill. And I said, how? He said, because you were not doing the things you wanted to do. You were drinking against your will. I saw you take a drink and hate it. And I was surprised. Naturally, it meant a great deal to him. And he went around with me to all of the meetings for a long time. I was very withdrawn, stood against the wall, and everyone thought that he was the alcoholic and I was the spouse. And this was fine with me, because for quite a while it was they, not we. And finally, one day he told me to go alone, because I was unable to meet anybody or talk to anybody. And he thought it would be better for me. And gradually, I did, and I joined a group, a very, very small group. And for 8 months, it was just wonderful. Going every night, I had not been able. My fears had kept me from going out after dark for a package of cigarettes. And here I would find myself on a street corner in Greenwich Village, completely alien territory, perfectly happy at 11 o'clock at night coming home. And the fellowship was just marvelous. And I heard so many speakers and so many people saying, well, you know, this is a wonderful program. I, who had been a reader all my life, was unable to concentrate yet on reading. I had not read the big book. I had seen the 12 steps hanging. They told me not to worry about them, that I didn't need them. We spoke about it in our group. Let us discuss the steps. Oh, no, they said, we don't want to do that. We have lots of things. And I would go home and tell my husband, you know, they all have resentments. They all have anger. They all have this and that. I'm not like that, am I? And he would say, no. And I say, they say it's the first drink. I'm not smart like some of the people who figured it out beforehand. I said, it's the third with me, isn't it? Yes, said he. So I said, and they are very sensitive, and I'm not. He said, well, now I think you are. He said, I think you're a little hypersensitive. Completely self-centered was what he really meant. And I said, they talk so much about the program, and I really and truly don't know what it is. And at this time, I started reading the big book. And I had heard so many people, so many members and speakers say, it works, I don't know how it works, but it works. And I came to chapter 5. And it said, how it works. It doesn't say, we don't know how it works. But it works? No. It said, rarely have we found, rarely have found a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And then the 12 steps which you have heard. And this was the program, the new way of life that AA offered, a way, a hope. The fellowship was marvelous, and I loved every minute of it. But as Bill W. has said in his latest book, The AA Way of Life, sobriety is a springboard. And you know, I think we alcoholics want everything. there is to have. I know I do, and I have met very few who were content with just the fellowship. I say just, and it sounds as if I'm belittling it. Indeed, it isn't. But I want everything I can get from this program. And it was at that time that I turned to a couple of members in our group, and we discussed having meetings for the steps. And so we started in our apartments, and every Sunday afternoon we met in a different apartment, and gradually people heard of it, and they came, and we became so big there weren't enough cups or anything else to go around. So we sought out a church, and we met in what was called the snake room of a church on 84th Street. The Jesuit fathers had it on 84th Street and Park Avenue. And the moment we get in there, you know, especially in the winter, all the pipes would start in, and in the summer we'd die of the heat, but we were one of the happiest groups, and we really still are. But week after week, we studied these steps. Just before this had come about, I had been asked if I would speak, and I panicked. The idea of having to get up, I had gone from meeting to meeting and heard people talking and gotten the message, but the idea of my speaking was incredible. And I said, what do I say? Why, I have no story. I haven't had very much to drink, or panic, lies, unreality. And they said, well, you just tell what you were like, how you came to AA, and how it is with you now. What was I like? I went home that night, what was I like? I didn't know what I was like. I had no idea of who I was and what I was. Nor did I really ever try to find out. I had not faced reality one bit. And when I made that first talk, I could only talk about what happened to me 3 weeks before I came into AA. I didn't know the Paula who had lived all these years. I knew nothing about it. It was through the steps, week after week, the first, the second, came to believe that a higher power higher than myself could restore me to sanity. This did not mean the insane things I did when drinking. This step was written by sober people in AA. Insanity, if I were to pick up a drink now, if I were to have a stinking attitude now that I'm sober. Week after week, this was one of the greatest investments I ever made in my life. And at the end of a year, and 12, of course, we've been around the 12 steps once and a half, I think, by then, or more, maybe twice. Some of the group began to grumble, and they said, look, we've done the steps. Done the steps. Every time you go around them, every time you find something new, this is a little tiny bit a measure of our own growth. I read the 12 and 12, and I read it today, and there are things in there that I swear weren't in there before. They have meaning for me now. It's really exciting. Year after year, for 5 years, gradually, I too was able to enter into the discussions, to find out a little about me, and to bring it out. And one thing, for instance, I had no resentments. I had no anger. I recall One of the worst resentments that I ever had, and it's been with me a long time. When I was quite young, I had scarlet fever and was in bed for 6 months. When I got up, I was in my teens, from a nice dainty little thing, here I was up here, looking down at my little playmates. And I was supposed to go to parties. Well, it was pretty rough. And you can get an idea if you can picture me in a chiffon gown in a pair of white sneakers. So I held that resentment for quite a while. Then I thought of another. I had a sister who was the younger one. She was closer to my mother. Approval. I didn't want approval, I demanded it. I wanted to be the loved one. The others were fine, my sisters, great, but I must be special. I realized that because I had met a friend of mother's and she had said, well, Paula, you're turning into a very pretty young lady. And this was great. I'd take this to mother and she'd love me, you know. Went home, told my mother that I met Mrs. Smith and what she had said. And mother, dear soul, said, oh, how nice. Wait until she sees Mary Frances. You know, these things I didn't recall. It was absolutely incredible. And then they talked about perfectionism. Well, I didn't feel that I was a perfectionist, but this was tied up with my fears. I had frightful fears, but I was a perfectionist. I discovered that I would not attempt to do a project or a job unless it was going to be the best. If I wasn't quite sure, I would say, give it to so-and-so. They know how to do it. I'm not good at that sort of thing. And then I would proceed to criticize so-and-so as they worked the project. Well, one of the things I learned and discovered in AA was this business of failures. I know Bill W. has said that AA was really built on failures. But the strange thing is that we never have to fail. We never have to be failures as long as we keep trying. I will take anything now and try to do it. I will do whatever is asked of me in AA or in my job. All the help in the world is there if I will go right ahead and do it and forget myself. Forget the fear of failure, because I can't fail. I can't be a failure. I can fail. I can fail again and again and again. And it is such a relief, because it helps one to be oneself. I said I couldn't speak, and one of the reasons why I couldn't, because I had to be as good as the best speaker, or I couldn't get up there. It was only finally when, at that particular time, there were a lot of women and there were three men week after week for a while that I realized that I owed something to AA, at least to tell the other women I am an alcoholic too, that I was able to get up. And through the steps, of course, the greatest thing to me was finding God as I understand Him. I had been a searcher. All my life, I had belonged to at least four different religions. And they're all great. But it was in AA that I felt complete freedom to seek out a God with whom I could communicate. Because, as I told you, it was through AA that I discovered communication. Quite some time ago, an article came to the grapevine, 5 or 6 years ago, from an English psychiatrist. He had it published in an English, The Observer. And he had been treating alcoholics for quite a while. Now he was interested in AA. And the reason being that a patient with whom he had had no success came to him and told him that he was recovering. And the doctor said, How? You are the most hopeless and helpless person I've ever had in here. And he said, because I went to AA, and for the first time in my life, I communicated with another human being. And I think this is what happens to all of us. It is, of course, the joining of the human race. I can also recall how many times people said to me, you can't possibly love your husband, or you wouldn't drink as you do or act as you do. And I was confused. I said, it hasn't anything to do with love. But I was wrong. You see, it has everything to do with love. I had no conception of how to love anyone or of how to receive love. Possessions, yes, but I knew nothing about love. Only gradually, through the 12 steps, and I know they're suggested, but not to me they're not. I think each of us have our musts. And I think that this is the way that I can become a whole woman. I don't want to settle for less, and I don't have to now that I have found AA, or AA has found me. And so can you understand how it is that first and above everything in my life, I love AA. Thank you for being here.